Would it have killed you to smile, Quincy? I spend a half hour poking around Lisa's photos, getting glimpses of an existence far different from mine. Although she had never married, settled down, and had kids, her life seemed to be a fulfilling one. Lisa had surrounded herself with people, family and friends and girls like Jade who just needed a kind presence. I could have been one of them, had I allowed it. Instead, I did the opposite. Keeping people at a safe distance. Pushing them away if necessary. Closeness was a luxury I couldn't afford to lose again. Scanning Lisa's photos, I mentally insert myself into each one. There I am, posing with her at the edge of the Grand Canyon. There we are, wiping mist from our faces in front of Niagara Falls. That's me, tucked into a group of women, kicking up our two-toned shoes at a bowling alley. "Bowling buddies," reads the caption. I pause at a picture Lisa had posted 3 weeks ago. It's a selfie, taken from a stretched, slightly overhead angle. In it, Lisa is raising a bottle of wine in what appears to be a wood-paneled dining room. For a caption, she had written, "Wine time, LOL!" There's a girl behind her, mostly cut out of the tilted frame. She reminds me of those alleged pictures of Bigfoot I sometimes see on cheesy paranormal shows. A blur of black hair turning away from the camera. I feel a kinship with that unnamed girl, even if I can't see her face. I, too, turned away from Lisa, retreating into the background alone. I became a blur, a smudge of darkness stripped of all my details.
Pine Cottage, 3:37 p.m. At first, the idea of the cabin made Quincy think of a fairy tale, mostly because of its whimsical name. Pine Cottage. Hearing it conjured up images of dwarfs and princesses and woodland creatures eager to help with chores. But as Craig's SUV bucked along the gravel drive and the cabin finally came into view, Quincy knew that her imagination had let her down. The reality of the place was far less fanciful. On the outside, Pine Cottage appeared squat, sturdy, and bluntly utilitarian, only slightly more elaborate than something that could be built with Lincoln logs. It sat among a cluster of tall pines that towered over the slate roof, making the place look smaller than it actually was. Huddled together with their branches intertwined, the trees surrounded the cabin in a thick wall, beyond which sat more trees, spreading outward in silent blackness. A dark forest. That was the fairy tale Quincy had been looking for, only it was more Brothers Grimm than Disney. When she stepped out of the SUV and peered into the tangled thicket, an unwelcome tickle of apprehension flitted over her. "So this is what the middle of nowhere looks like," she announced. "It's creepy, scaredy cat," Janelle said as she moved behind Quincy, lugging not one but two suitcases. "Overpacker," Quincy shot back. Janelle jutted out her tongue, holding the pose until Quincy realized she was supposed to grab her camera and capture it for posterity. Dutifully, she dug her new Nikon out of its bag and snapped a few shots. She kept on shooting once Janelle broke the pose and tried to lift both of her suitcases, thin arms straining. "Quincy," she said in that sing-songy voice Quincy knew all too well. "Help me carry these. Pretty please." Quincy looped the camera around her neck. "Nope, you're the one who brought all that stuff. I doubt you'll even use half of it." "But I'm prepared for anything. Isn't that, like, what the Boy Scouts say?"
"Be prepared," Craig said, passing them both with a cooler perched on his sturdy shoulders. "And I hope one of the things you packed was the key to this place." Janelle jumped at the excuse to ignore her suitcases and searched the pockets of her jeans until she found the key. She then bounded to the front door, giving a smack to the cedar sign that bore the cabin's name. "Group portrait," she suggested. Quincy set the camera's timer and placed it on the hood of Greg's SUV. Then she rushed to join the others in front of the cabin. All six of them held their smiles, waiting for the shutter's telltale click. The East Hall crew, as Janelle had dubbed them during freshman orientation, still thick as thieves 2 months into their sophomore year. Picture time over, Janelle ceremoniously unlocked the front door. "What do you think?" she asked as soon as it creaked open, before the rest of them had more than a scant second to take in their surroundings. "It's cozy, right?" Quincy agreed, although her idea of coziness wasn't bare skin on the walls and a well-trod rug tossed over the floor. She would have used the word rustic, with an emphasis on the rust, which ringed the kitchen sink and tinted the water sputtering from the pipes in the only bathroom. But it was big, as far as cabins went. 4 bedrooms. A deck in the back that only shimmied slightly when they stepped onto it. A great room with a field stone fireplace roughly the size of the dorm room Janelle and Quincy shared, logs tidily stacked beside it. The cabin, the whole weekend actually, was a birthday present for Janelle from her mom and stepdad. They aspired to be the cool parents, the ones who thought of their children as friends. The ones who assumed their college-age daughter was drinking and getting high anyway, so they might as well rent her a cabin in the Poconos to do it all in relative safety. 48 hours free of RAs, dorm food, and ID cards that had to be swiped at every door and elevator. But before it could begin, Janelle ordered them all to place their cell phones inside a small wooden box. "No calls, no texts, and definitely no pictures or video," she said, before stuffing the box into the SUV's glove compartment. "What about my camera?" Quincy asked. "I'll allow it, but you can only take flattering pictures of me." "Of course," Quincy said. "I mean it," Janelle warned. "If I see anything that goes down this weekend on Facebook, I will unfriend you, online and in real life." Then, on her mark, all six of them sprinted to the bedrooms, each trying to claim the best one. Amy and Rodney grabbed the one with the waterbed, which sloshed wildly when they threw themselves on top of it. Betts, not having a boyfriend to bring along, dutifully took the room with bunk beds, flopping onto the bottom one with her dictionary-thick copy of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. Quincy pulled Janelle into the one with twin beds pressed against opposite walls, just like their dorm room. "Home sweet home," Quincy said, or at least a close enough approximation. "Nice," Janelle said, the word sounding hollow to Quincy's ears. "I don't know, though. We can pick another room. It's your birthday. You've got first choice." "You're right. And I choose..." Janelle grabbed Quincy by the shoulders, lifting her from the lumpy bed, to sleep alone. She steered Quincy into the hall, toward the room at the end of it. The cabin's largest, it boasted a bay window with a sweeping view of the woods. Several quilts adorned the walls in homespun kaleidoscopes of fabric. And there, seated on the edge of the king bed, was Craig. He looked at the floor, staring at the space between his Converse high tops. His hands rested on his lap, fingers laced, thumbs rolling over each other. He looked up when Quincy entered. She noticed a hopeful lift in his shy smile. "I'm sure this will be much more comfortable," Janelle said, a wink in her voice. "You two have fun." She knocked a hip against Quincy, nudging her deeper into the room. Then she was gone, closing the door behind her and giggling back down the hall.
"It was her idea," Craig said.
"I assumed that."
"We don't have to..."
He stopped, forcing Quincy to fill in the blank. Room together? Sleep together like Janelle so blatantly planned for them to do?
It's fine, she said.
Quinn, really, if you're not ready.
Quincy sat beside him and put a hand on his trembling knee. Craig Anderson, the budding basketball star, brown-haired, green-eyed, sexily lanky Craig. Out of all the girls on campus, he picked her.
It's fine, she said again,
meaning it as much as a 19-year-old contemplating the end of her virginity possibly could.
I'm glad.
4. Jeff finds me on the sofa with Lisa's book in my lap and my eyes raw from an afternoon spent crying. When he drops his suitcase and sweeps me into his arms, I lay my head against his chest and weep some more. After 2 years of living together and 2 more of dating, he knows not to immediately ask what's wrong. He simply lets me cry. It's only after I've soaked his shirt collar with tears that I say, Lisa Milner killed herself. Jeff's grip around me tightens. The Lisa Milner?
The very one.
That's all he needs me to say. The rest he understands.
Oh, Quinn. Hon, I'm so sorry. When? What happened?
We settle back onto the sofa and I give Jeff the details. He listens with a heightened interest, a byproduct of his job, which requires him to absorb all information before sifting through it.
How do you feel?
He asks when I'm done talking.
Fine, I say. I'm just shocked.
And in mourning,
which is silly, I guess.
It's not, Jeff says. You have every right to be upset.
Do I? It's not like Lisa and I ever actually met.
That doesn't matter. You two spoke a lot. She helped you. You were kindred spirits.
We were victims, I say. That's the only thing we had in common.
You don't need to trivialize it, Quinn. Not with me. That's Jefferson Richards, the public defender, talking. He lapses into lawyer speak whenever he disagrees with me, which isn't often. Usually, he's simply Jeff, the boyfriend who doesn't mind cuddling, who's a far better cook than I and whose ass looks amazing in the suits he wears to court.
I can't begin to understand what you went through that night, he says. No one can. No one but Lisa and that other girl.
Samantha. Jeff repeats the name absently, as if he knew it all along. Samantha. I'm sure she feels the same way you do.
It doesn't make any sense, I say. I can't understand why Lisa would kill herself after everything she went through. It's such a waste. I thought Lisa was better than that.
Once again, I hear her voice in my head.
There's nobility in being a survivor, she had once told me. Grace, too. Because we've suffered and lived. We have the power to inspire others who are suffering.
It was bullshit. All of it.
Sorry for being such a mess, I tell Jeff. Lisa's suicide. My reaction. All of it feels abnormal.
Of course it does. What happened to you was abnormal. But one of the things I love about you is how you haven't let it define you. You've moved on.
Jeff's told me this before, quite a few times, in fact. After so many repetitions, I've actually started to believe it.
I know, I say. I have.
Which is the only healthy thing you can do. That's the past. This is the present. And I'd like to think that the present makes you happy.
Jeff smiles just then. He has the smile of a movie star. CinemaScope wide and technicolor bright. It's what first drew me to him when we met at a work event so dull I felt the need to get tipsy and flirty.
Let me guess, I told him, you're a toothpaste model.
Guilty as charged.
What brand? Maybe I'll start using it.
Aquafresh. But I'm aiming for the big time. Crest.
I laughed, even though it wasn't all that funny. There was something endearing about his eagerness to please. He reminded me of a golden retriever, soft and loyal and safe. Even though I didn't yet know his name, I clasped his hand. I haven't really let go of it since. Between Pine Cottage and Jeff, my social life was quiet to the point of non-existence. Once I was deemed well enough to return to school, I didn't go back to my old college, where I knew I'd be haunted by memories of Janelle and the others. Instead, I transferred to a school slightly closer to home, spending 3 years living alone in a dorm room designed for two. My reputation preceded me, of course. People knew exactly who I was and what I had gone through. But I kept my head down, stayed quiet, took my daily Xanax and grape soda. I was friendly but friendless, approachable yet purposefully aloof. I saw no point in getting too close with anyone. Once a week, I attended a group therapy session in which a grab bag of afflictions was dealt with. Those of us who attended became sort of friends. Not close exactly, but trusted enough to call when one of us was too anxious to go to the movies alone. Even then, I had a hard time relating to these vulnerable girls who had endured rape, physical abuse, disfiguring car accidents. Their trauma was far different from my own. None of them knew what it felt like to have their closest friends snatched away in a single instant. They didn't understand how awful it was to not remember the worst night of your life. I got the sense my lack of memories made them jealous, that they too wanted only to forget, as if forgetting were somehow easier than remembering. While at school, I attracted an interchangeable string of skinny, sensitive boys who wanted to unlock the mysteries of the shy, quiet girl who kept everyone at arm's length. I indulged them to a degree. Awkward study dates, coffeehouse chats where I amused myself by counting the ways they avoided bringing up Pine Cottage. Maybe a teasing kiss goodnight if I was feeling especially lonely. Secretly, I preferred the jockish types found solely at frat parties and raucous keggers. You know the type. Big arms, beefy pecs, and slight beer gut. Guys who don't care about your scars. Who are incapable of being gentle. Who are all too happy to tirelessly fuck, piston-like, and definitely not upset when you slip out afterward without giving them your number. After those encounters, I'd leave feeling sore and chafed and oddly invigorated. There's something energizing about getting what you want, even if that something is shame. But Jeff is different. He's perfectly normal. Polo by Ralph Lauren normal. We dated an entire month before I dared bring up Pine Cottage. He still thought I was Quincy Carpenter, marketing grunt about to start a baking blog. He had no idea I was actually Quincy Carpenter, massacre survivor. To his credit, he took it better than I expected. He said all the right things, ending with, "I firmly believe it's possible for people not to be harnessed to bad things from their past. People can recover. They can move on. You certainly have." That's when I knew he was a keeper. "So how was Chicago?" I ask. From the half-shrug Jeff gives me, I can tell it didn't go well. "I didn't get the information I was hoping for," he says. "Actually, I'd rather not talk about it."
"And I'd rather not talk about Lisa."
Jeff stands, struck with an idea. "Then we should go out. We should get dressed up, go someplace fancy, and drown our sorrows in too much food and booze. You game?" I shake my head and stretch cat-like across the sofa. I just don't have it in me tonight. But you know what I'd really like?
"Wine from a box," Jeff says.
"And?"
"Take out pad thai."
I muster a smile. You know me so well.
Later, Jeff and I make love. I am the initiator, tugging the case file out of his hands and climbing on top of him. Jeff protests, a little. It's more like feigned protest. Soon he's inside me, exceedingly gentle and attentive. Jeff is a talker. Having sex with him involves fielding 100 questions. Does that feel good? Too rough? Like that? Most of the time I appreciate his thoughtfulness, his vocal desire to meet my needs. Tonight is different. Lisa's death has put me in a mood. Instead of the ebb and flow of pleasure, dissatisfaction seeps into my body. I want the impersonal thrusting of those nameless frat boys who thought they were seducing me when it was the other way around. It's like an internal rash, irritated and itchy, and Jeff's earnest lovemaking doesn't come close to scratching it. Yet I pretend it does. I fake moan and squeal like a porn star. When Jeff asks for a progress report, I cover his mouth with mine, just so he'll stop talking. Afterward, we cuddle while watching Turner Classic Movies. Our usual post-coital habit. Lately, that's become my favorite part of sex. The aftermath. Feeling his firm and furry body next to mine as rapid-fire 40-speak lulls us to sleep. But tonight, sleep doesn't come easily. Part of it is the movie, The Lady from Shanghai. We've reached the ending. Rita Hayworth and Orson Welles in the Hall of Mirrors, their reflections shattering in a hail of bullets. The other part is Jeff, who shifts uneasily beside me, restless under the covers. Eventually, he says, "Are you sure you don't want to talk about what happened with Lisa Milner?" I close my eyes, wishing sleep would grab me by the throat and drag me under. "There's not really anything to talk about," I say. "Do you want to talk about your thing?" "It's not a thing," Jeff says, bristling. "It's my job." "Sorry," I pause, still not looking at him, trying to gauge his level of annoyance with me. "Do you want to talk about your job?" "No," he says, before changing his mind. "Maybe a little." I roll over and sit up, leaning on my left elbow. "I gather the defense isn't going well?" "Not really. Which is all I can legally say about it." There's very little Jeff's allowed to tell me about his cases. Client confidentiality rules extend even to spouses, or, in my case, eventual ones. It's another reason Jeff and I are a good fit. He can't talk about work. I don't want to talk about my past. We get to hopscotch over two of the conversational traps that usually ensnare couples. Yet for the first time in months, I feel like we're close to being caught in one and struggling mightily to avoid it. "We should sleep," I say. "Don't you have to be in court early tomorrow?" "I do," Jeff says, looking not at me but at the ceiling. "And did you even stop to consider that's why I can't sleep?" "I didn't." I drop onto my back again. "I'm sorry." "I don't think you understand how big this case is." "It's been on the news, Jeff. I've got a pretty good idea." Now it's Jeff's turn to sit up, lean on his elbow, look at me. "If this goes well, it could mean big things for me, for us. Do you think I want to be a public defender forever?"
"I don't know. Do you?"
"Of course not. Winning this case could be a huge stepping stone. Hopefully to one of the big firms, where I can start making real money and not live in an apartment paid for by my girlfriend's victim fund."
I'm too hurt to respond, although I can tell Jeff instantly regrets saying it. His eyes go dead for a second, and his mouth twists in distress.
"Quinn, I didn't mean that."
"I know." I slide out of bed, still naked, feeling exposed and vulnerable by that fact. I grab the first article of clothing I can get my hands on, Jeff's threadbare terry cloth robe, and slip it on. It's fine.
It's not fine, Jeff says. I'm an asshole.
Get some sleep, I tell him. Tomorrow's important. I pad into the living room, suddenly and irrevocably awake. My phone sits atop the coffee table, still turned off. I switch it on, the screen glowing ice blue in the darkness. I have 23 missed calls, 18 texts, and more than 3 dozen emails. Virtually all of them are from reporters. Word of Lisa's death has gotten out. The press is officially on the hunt. I scroll through my email inbox, which has gone neglected since the previous evening. Buried beneath the wall of reporter inquiries are earlier, more benign missives from fans of the website and various makers of baking tools eager for me to give their wares a test drive. One email address stands out from the flow of names and numbers, like a silver-scaled fish breaching the surface. L. Milner, 75. My finger jumps off the screen. An involuntary recoil. I stare at the address until it sears itself onto my vision, the after-image lingering when I blink. I know of only one person who could have that address, and she's been dead for more than a day. The realization forms a nervous tickle in my throat. I swallow hard before opening the email.
Quincy, I need to talk to you. It's extremely important. Please, please don't ignore this.
Beneath it is Lisa's name and the same phone number written inside her book. I read the email several times, the tickle in my throat transforming into a sensation that can only be described as fluttering. It feels like I've swallowed a hummingbird, its wings beating against my esophagus. I check when the email was sent. 11 p.m. Taking into account the several minutes it took for police to trace the 911 call and get to her house, it means that Lisa sent the email less than an hour before she killed herself. I might have been the last person she ever tried to contact. 5. Morning arrives gray and groggy. I awake to find Jeff already gone, off to meet his accused cop killer. In the kitchen, a surprise awaits me. A vase filled not with flowers, but baking tools. Wooden spoons and spatulas and a heavy-duty whisk with a handle as thick as my wrist. A red ribbon has been wrapped around the vase's neck. Attached to it is a card. I'm an idiot, and I'm sorry. You will always be my favorite sweet. Love, Jeff. Next to the vase, the unfinished cupcakes resume staring at me. I ignore them as I take my morning Xanax with 2 swallows of grape soda. I then switch to coffee, mainlining it in the breakfast nook, trying to wake up. My sleep had been plagued with nightmares, a phase I thought had passed. In the first few years after Pine Cottage, I couldn't go a night without having one. They were the usual therapy fodder. Running through the woods, Janelle stumbling from the trees, him. Lately, though, I go weeks, even months, without having one. Last night, my dreams were filled with reporters scratching at the windows and leaving bloody claw marks on the glass. Pale and thin, they moaned my name, waiting like vampires for me to invite them in. Instead of fangs, their teeth were pencils narrowed to ice-pick sharpness, glistening chunks of sinew stuck to the tips. Lisa made an appearance in one of the nightmares, looking exactly like the picture on her book jacket. The well-practiced form of her lips never wavered. Not even when she grabbed a pencil from one of the reporters and dragged its point across her wrists. Her email was the first thing I thought of upon waking, of course. It spent the night sitting in my mind like a spring-loaded trap, waiting for the smallest bit of consciousness to set it off. It remains gripped to my brain as I down one cup of coffee, then another. Foremost in my thoughts is the unshakable idea that, other than her aborted 911 call, I truly had been the last person Lisa tried to contact. If that's the case, why? Did she want me, of all people, to try to talk her off whatever mental ledge she had crawled onto? Did my failure to check my email make me in some way responsible for her death? My first instinct is to call Coop and tell him about it. I have no doubt he'd drop everything and drive into Manhattan for the second day in a row just to assure me that nothing about this is my fault. But I'm not sure I want to see Coop on consecutive days. It would be the first time that happened since Pine Cottage and the morning after, and it's not an experience I long to repeat. I text him instead, trying to keep it casual. Call me when you get a chance. No rush. Nothing important. But my gut tells me it is important. Or at least it has the potential to be. If it wasn't important, why did I wake up thinking about it? Why is my next thought to call Jeff just to hear his voice, even though I know he's in court, his cell phone switched off and shoved into the depths of his briefcase? I try not to think about it, although that proves to be impossible. According to my phone, I've missed a dozen more calls. My voicemail is a swamp of messages. I listened to only one of them, a surprise message from my mother, who called at an hour when she knew I'd still be asleep. The latest of her constantly evolving attempts to avoid actual conversation. "Quincy, it's your mother," her message begins, as if she doesn't trust me to recognize her nasal monotone. "I was just woken up by a reporter calling to see if I had a comment about what happened to that Lisa Milner girl you were friends with. I told him he should talk to you. Thought you'd like to know." I see no point in calling her back. That's the last thing my mother wants. It's been that way ever since I returned to college after Pine Cottage. As a new widow, she wanted me to commute from home. When I didn't, she said I was abandoning her. Ultimately, though, it was me who got abandoned. By the time I finally graduated, she had remarried a dentist named Fred who came with three adult children from a previous marriage. Three happy, bland, toothy children. Not a final girl in the bunch. They became her family. I became a barely tolerated remnant of her past. A blemish on her otherwise spotless new life. I listen again to my mother's message, searching for the slightest hint of interest or concern in her voice. Finding none, I delete the voicemail and move on to that morning's copy of the Times. To my surprise, an article about Lisa's death rests at the bottom of the front page. I read it in one distasteful gulp. Muncie, Indiana. Lisa Milner, a prominent child psychologist who was the lone survivor of a sorority house massacre that shocked campuses nationwide, died at her home here, authorities confirmed yesterday. She was 42. Most of the article focuses on the horrors Lisa witnessed that long ago night, as if no other moments of her life mattered. Reading it gives me a glimpse of what my own obituary will be like. It churns my stomach. Yet one sentence gives me pause. It's near the bottom, almost like an afterthought. Police are continuing their investigation. Investigation of what? Lisa slit her wrists, which seems pretty straightforward to me. Then I remember what Coop said about the toxicology tests, to see if Lisa was on something at the time. Tossing the newspaper aside, I reach for my laptop. Online, I skip the news sites and head straight for the true crime blogs, an alarming number of which are solely devoted to final girls. The guys who run them, and they are all men, by the way, Women have better things to do. Still occasionally contact me through my website, trying to sweet-talk me into giving an interview. I never reply. The closest we've come to corresponding was after I received that threatening letter and Coop wrote them all, asking if one of them had sent it. They all said no. Normally I avoid these sites, fearful of what I might see written about me. Today, however, calls for an exception, and I find myself clicking through website after website. Nearly all of them have mentions of Lisa's suicide. Like the article in the Times, there's little to no new information. Most of them stress the irony of a world-famous survivor being responsible for her own death. One even has the gall to suggest other final girls could follow suit. Disgusted, I close the browser window and slam the laptop shut. I then stand, trying to shake away some of the angry adrenaline scooting through my body. All that Xanax, caffeine, and misguided web surfing have left me antsy and aggravated. So much so that I change into workout clothes and lace up my running shoes. When I get like this, which is often, the only cure is to jog until it passes. In the elevator, it dawns on me that there could be reporters outside. If they know my phone number and email address, there's every reason to think they also know where I live. I make a plan to start running as soon as I hit the street, instead of taking my customary stroll to Central Park. I begin while still inside the building, busting out of the elevator at a light jog. Once outside, though, I see there's no need. Instead of a crush of reporters out front, I'm confronted by exactly one. He looks young, eager, and handsome in a nerdy way. Buddy Holly glasses, great hair. More Clark Kent than Jimmy Olsen. He rushes toward me as I trot from the building, the pages of his notebook fluttering. Miss Carpenter! He tells me his name, Jonah Thompson. I recognize it. He's one of the reporters who called, emailed, and texted. The nuisance trifecta. He then tells me the name of the paper he works for. One of the major daily tabloids. Judging by his age, it means he's either very good at his job or else incredibly unscrupulous. I suspect it's both. No comment, I say, breaking into a full run. He makes an attempt to keep up, the flat soles of his Oxfords clapping against the sidewalk. I just have a few questions about Lisa Milner. No comment, I say again. If you're still here when I get back, I'm calling the police. Jonah Thompson falls back while I keep moving. I feel him watch my retreat, his gaze a sunburn on the back of my neck. I increase my pace, quickly navigating the crossblocks to Central Park. Before entering, I glance over my shoulder, just in case he somehow managed to follow me there. Not likely. Not in those shoes. In the park, I head north toward the reservoir. My preferred jogging spot. It's flatter than other areas of the park, with better sight lines. No curving paths with God knows what waiting just around the bend. No pockets of trees thick with shadows. Just long stretches of gravel where I can clench my jaw, straighten my back, and run. But on this crisp morning, it's hard to focus on running. My thoughts are elsewhere. I think about fresh-faced Jonah Thompson and his annoying tenacity. I think about the article on Lisa's death and its refusal to acknowledge how what she went through messed her up so much she decided to sink a knife into both her wrists. Mostly, though, I dwell on Lisa herself and what possibly could have been going through her mind when she sent me that email. Was she sad? Desperate? Was the knife already gripped in her trembling hands? It's suddenly all too much, and the adrenaline drains from my limbs as quickly as it filled them. Other joggers continually pass me, the gravelly crunch of their footsteps warning of their approach. Giving up, I slow to a stroll, move to the path's edge, and walk the rest of the way home. Back at my building, I'm relieved to see that Jonah Thompson has departed. In his place, though, is another reporter, idling on the other side of the street. On second glance, I decide she's not a traditional reporter. She looks too edgy for mainstream media, reminding me of those aging riot girls who roamed Williamsburg before the hipsters took over. A woman who doesn't give a shit she's dressed like someone half her age. Leather jacket sitting over a hip-hugging black dress. Fishnet stockings rising out of scuffed combat boots. Her raven hair is a parted curtain that provides only a partial view of eyes ringed with liner. She wears red lipstick as bright as blood. A blogger, I surmise. One with a far different readership from me. Yet there's something familiar about her. I've seen her before. Maybe. My stomach flips with the sensation of not recognizing someone even when I know I should. She recognizes me, though. Her raccoon eyes assess me through the dark drapes of her hair. I watch her watch me. She doesn't even blink. She merely slouches against the building across the street, making no attempt to blend in with her surroundings. A cigarette juts from her ruby lips, smoke swirling. I'm about to head inside when she calls to me. Quincy. It's a statement, not a question. Hey, Quincy Carpenter. I stop, do a half turn, frown in her direction. No comment. She scowls, a storm cloud darkening the landscape of her face. I don't want a comment. Then what do you want? I say, facing her head on, attempting to stare her down. I just want to talk. About Lisa Milner? Yeah, she says. And other stuff. Which makes you a reporter, and I have no comment. She mutters Jesus Christ and tosses the cigarette into the street. She reaches for a large knapsack sitting at her feet. Heavy and full, whatever's inside presses against the frayed seams when she lifts it. Soon she's across the street, right in front of me, dropping the knapsack so close to me that it almost lands on my right foot. You don't need to be such a bitch, she says. Excuse me? Listen. All I want to do is talk. Up close, her voice sounds husky and seductive. Cigarettes and whiskey ride her breath. After what happened to Lisa, I thought it might be a good idea. I suddenly realize who she is. She looks different from what I expected. A far cry from the yearbook photo that was printed everywhere one long ago summer. Gone is the too high hair, the ruddy cheeks, the double chin. She's thinned out since then, shed the cherubic glow of youth. Time has made her a taut and weary version of her former self. Samantha Boyd, I say. She nods. I prefer Sam. 6. Samantha Boyd. The second final girl. Of the three of us, she probably had it the worst. She was 2 weeks out of high school when it happened. Just a girl trying to scrape together enough money to pay for community college. She got a job cleaning rooms at a highway motel outside Tampa called the Nightlight Inn. Because she was new, Samantha had to work the red-eye shift, fetching towels for exhausted truckers and changing sheets that reeked of sweat and semen in rooms occupied only half the night. 2 hours into her fourth shift, a man with a potato sack over his head showed up, and all hell broke loose. He was an itinerant handyman with a boner for the parts of the Bible few like to talk about. Horrors of Babylon, smiting the sinners, eyes for eyes, and teeth for teeth. His name was Calvin Whitmer. But after that summer, he would be forever known as the Sack Man. The name fit, for he carried lots of things in sacks. The back of his pickup was full of them. Sacks of empty tin cans, sacks of animal skins, sacks of sand, salt, pebbles. Then there was the sack of tools he carried to the Nightlight Inn, filled with saw blades and chisels and masonry nails. Police found 21 tools in all, most of them crusted with blood. Samantha personally met two of them. One was a sharpened drill bit that found its way into her back. Twice. The other was a hacksaw that caught her upper thigh, severing an artery. Her brush with the drill bit came before the sack man lashed her to a tree behind the motel with a loop of barbed wire. The hacksaw was after she had somehow managed to break free. 6 people died that night. 4 motel guests, a nighttime desk clerk named Troy, and Calvin Whitmer. That last one was Sam's doing, once she freed herself and got her hands on the same drill bit that had entered her back. She leapt atop the sack man and plunged it into his chest again and again and again. The cops found her like that, trailing barbed wire, straddling a dead man, stabbing away. I know all this because it was in Time magazine, which my parents assumed I never read. That issue I did, poring over the article under the covers, penlight clenched in my sweaty palm. I had nightmares for a week. Sam's story, meanwhile, made the same rounds as Lisa's and, eventually, mine. Evening news, front pages, magazine covers. Oh, how the reporters came running. Probably the very ones who would later camp on my parents' front lawn. Sam granted a handful of print interviews, plus an exclusive one to that TV bitch with the Chanel-scented paper, likely for more or less the same price given to me. Her only condition was that her face couldn't be shown on camera, nor could any new photographs be taken of her. All anyone saw was that single yearbook photo, the permanent face of her particular ordeal. That's why it was a big deal when she agreed to join Lisa and me in a chat with Oprah, on camera, for all the world to see. Which made it a bigger deal when I backed out. Because of me, no one got to glimpse another view of Samantha Boyd. A year after that, she vanished. It wasn't a sudden thing, her disappearance. Instead, it was a slow fading, like morning fog sapping away in the sun. Reporters writing about the 10th anniversary of the Nightlight Inn murders suddenly had a hard time tracking her down. Her mother eventually came forward to admit she'd lost touch. Federal authorities, who liked to keep tabs on victims of violent crimes, couldn't find her. She was gone. Off the grid, as Coop puts it. No one knows for sure what happened, but that didn't keep theories from sprouting and spreading like mold spores. One article I read surmised that she had changed her name and moved to South America. Another suggested that she was living in isolation somewhere out west. The murder porn sites took a darker view, naturally, tossing out conspiracy theories involving suicide, kidnapping, government cover-ups. But now she's here, right in front of me. Her appearance is so unexpected that I'm at a loss for words. All I can muster is, "What are you doing here?" Sam rolls her eyes. "You really suck at this hello thing." "Sorry," I say. "Hello." "Good job." "Thanks. But it still doesn't tell me why you're here." "Isn't it obvious? I'm here to see you." Sam's voice brings to mind a speakeasy, smoky and booze-scented. It contains the dark lilt of something forbidden. "I thought we should finally meet." We stare at each other a moment, each of us assessing the damage to the other. I get the feeling Sam has also read up on me, because she eyes my stomach first, then my shoulder. I, meanwhile, sneak a glance at her leg, trying to remember if there was a noticeable limp when she crossed the street. Thoughts of Lisa slide into my head. "We're a rare breed," she once told me. "We need to stick together." Now that she's gone, no one else can understand what we've been through. Sam and I are the only ones. And while I still don't fully comprehend why she's come out of hiding simply to see me, I find myself giving a reluctant nod. "And so we have," I say, my voice still dulled by surprise. "Would you like to come up?" We sit in the living room, not drinking the coffee I've set out in front of us. I've since changed out of my running clothes into blue jeans, red flats, and a turquoise blouse. A splash of color to counteract all of Sam's black. I perch on a straight-backed chair upholstered in purple velvet. Stiff and punishing, it's more for show than for sitting. Sam is on the antique sofa, looking equally as uncomfortable. She sits with her knees together, arms tied at her sides, trying to make small talk, which clearly isn't her forte. The words come out in short, intense bursts. Each one is like a cherry bomb that's been quickly tossed. "Nice place."
"Thanks."
"Looks big."
"It's not bad. We only have the two bedrooms."
I cringe as I say it. "Only." As if I'm somehow deprived. Judging from the bulging knapsack Sam brought with her, I'm not sure she has a room. "Nice." Sam shifts on the sofa. I get the sense she's trying hard to resist kicking off her boots and spreading herself across it. She looks as uncomfortable as I feel. "Not that this place is small," I say, the words spilling out in a desperate attempt not to sound like I'm spoiled. "I understand how lucky I am. And the spare room is nice to have when Jeff's family comes to visit. Jeff, that's my boyfriend. His parents are in Delaware, and his brother, sister-in-law, and two nephews live in Maryland. They like to visit a lot. It's fun having kids around sometimes." I love Jeff's family. All of them as catalog perfect as Jeff himself. They all know about Pine Cottage. Jeff told them as soon as it was clear things between us were getting serious. Those solid middle-class Protestants didn't bat an eye. His mother even sent me a fruit basket with a handwritten note saying she hoped it would brighten my day.
"What about your family?"
Sam says.
"What about them?"
"Do they visit a lot?"
I think about my mother's one and only visit. She invited herself, using the excuse that she was going through a rough patch with Fred and just wanted to get away for a weekend. Jeff saw it as a good sign. Naively, I did too. I thought my mother would be impressed with the new life I had created. Instead, she spent the entire weekend criticizing everything from the clothes I wore to how much wine I drank at dinner. By the time she left, we were barely speaking.
"No," I tell Sam, "they don't." "What about yours?"
"Same."
I once saw Mrs. Boyd in an interview on 2020 shortly after the world realized Sam was missing. She was a scrubby thing, with red blotches on her skin and 2 inches of dark roots seeping into her bleached hair. During the interview, she came across as jarringly unsentimental about her daughter. The hard set of her jaw made her voice mealy and unkind. She looked tired and rubbed raw. Even though Sam has that same weary air about her, I can see why she wanted to escape such a woman. Mrs. Boyd resembled a house roughed up by too many storms. My mother is the opposite. Sheila Carpenter refuses to let anyone see the wear and tear. When I was in the hospital after Pine Cottage, she showed up each morning in full makeup, not a hair out of place. Sure, her only child had barely escaped a madman who slaughtered all her friends, But that was no excuse to appear unkempt. If Sam's mother is a fixer-upper, mine is a suburban McMansion rotting on the inside. Last I heard, you sort of vanished, I say.
Kind of, Sam says.
Where were you all those years?
Here and there. You know, just laying low.
I find myself sitting with my arms locked across my chest, hands buried in my armpits. I pry them out and fold them primly on my lap. Within seconds, though, my arms have assumed their original position. My whole body thirsts for a Xanax. Sam doesn't notice. She's too busy tucking her hair behind her ears to give the apartment another vaguely critical once-over. I've decorated the place with an emphasis on shabby chic. Everything is mismatched, from the blue walls to the flea market lamps to the white shag carpeting I purchased ironically but ended up loving. It is, I realize, the apartment of someone trying to disguise how much money they really have, and I can't tell if Sam is impressed or annoyed by that.
Do you work? She asks.
Yes, I'm stalling, which I always do before telling someone my flighty, fanciful job, especially someone like Sam, who carries an aura of lifelong poverty. It's evident in the runs in her fishnets, her duct-taped boots, her hard eyes. Desperation hums off her like radio waves, shivery and intense.
You don't have to tell me, she says. I mean, you don't even know me.
I'm a blogger? It comes out sounding like a question, like I have no clue what I am. I have a website. It's called Quincy Sweets. Sam offers a polite half-smile.
Cute name. Is it, like, kittens and shit?
Baked goods. Cakes, cookies, muffins. I post pictures and decorating tips. Recipes. Tons of recipes. It's been featured on the Food Network.
Jesus. Bragging about the Food Network? Even I want to smack myself.
But Sam greets it all with a laid-back nod.
Cool, she says.
It can be fun, I say, finally wrangling my voice to a lower register.
Why cakes? Why not world hunger or politics or...
kittens and shit? This time, Sam's smile is full and genuine.
Yeah, that.
I've always liked to bake. It's one of the few things I'm good at. It relaxes me. Makes me happy. After... I hesitate again for a very different reason. After what happened to me...
You mean the Pine Cottage murders? Sam says.
At first, I'm surprised she knows the name. Then I realize it's natural that she would. Just like how I know about the Nightlight Inn. Yes, I say. After that, when I was living at home, I spent a lot of time baking things for friends and neighbors. Thank you presents, really. People were so generous. A new casserole every night for weeks.
All that food.
Sam lifts her fingers to her teeth, gnawing at the cuticles. The sleeve of her leather jacket slips, revealing dark ink at her wrist. A tattoo, hidden just out of sight.
It must have been a nice neighborhood.
It was. Sam catches a hangnail in her teeth, tugs it off, spits it out.
Mine wasn't.
Silence follows as questions flicker in my mind. Personal ones Sam might not want to answer. How long did the barbed wire keep you against that tree? How did you get loose? What did it feel like plunging that drill bit into Calvin Whitmer's heart? Instead, I say, should we talk about what happened to Lisa?
You make it sound like we've got a choice.
We don't have to.
She killed herself, Sam says. Of course we do.
Why do you think she did it?
Maybe she couldn't take it anymore.
I know what she means. It is the guilt, the nightmares, the lingering grief. Most of all, it is the gnawing, unshakable sense that maybe my survival wasn't